This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.
At a certain point, you have to own up to the fact that human beings are imperfect. And sometimes the very thing that makes us bad at detecting deception is the thing that makes us good at everything else.
Hello, welcome to The Klein Show on the Vox Media Podcast Network. My guest today needs very little introduction. He's been on the show before, Malcolm Gladwell, the author of the new book, Talking to Strangers, which is the second Talking to Strangers author we've had on the podcast just in a little bit. I think we're doing them both in a week. So I think these actually interviews play off each other in an interesting way. So it's Talking to Strangers week here at The Ezra Klein Show. And of course, host of the Revisionist podcast. We talk about things that are random and we talk about things here that are very deep and specific. But he's a fascinating guy with a very fascinating thought process. So I think y'all enjoy it. As always, my email is EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. Again, EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. Here's Malcolm Gladwell. Malcolm Gladwell, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Let's begin with your rules for life. Your overriding rule in life is pull the goalie. What does that mean?
I did a podcast once. In a high state of podcast episode once, in a high state of whimsy, in which I was exploring the notion of when all is lost, then extreme measures are called for. When all seems lost, extreme measures are called for, and it was based on this hilarious study in SSRN about how deep into a hockey, or how soon should you pull your goalie in a hockey game if you're down by one or two goals? And the answer is way sooner than hockey coaches do. They typically pull the goalie with a minute left. And if you're down a goal, you should actually do it with 5 minutes left, these guys calculated. And I just thought this as a general principle of life was enormously interesting. And I wondered whether it applied to me. And does it apply to me? I think it just applies to all of us.
What is a general principle of life?
Well, the general principle would be that low probability events require extreme responses. If your chances of winning a hockey game are 2%, then you can justify doing incredibly radical things to win, right? Because you're just not going to win otherwise. So, you could say, I suppose, as the probability of devastating consequences of climate change grow greater and greater and greater, the number of extreme ideas we should be considering ought to grow commensurately.
This is a kind of a risk management
idea. Yeah, it's a simple, or in football, once you're behind by two touchdowns in the fourth quarter, you should never be punting on fourth down, like ever. Or you should be, doing trick plays. You should do anything to disrupt the rhythm of the game because the rhythm of the game is not going your way.
Have you ever applied this in your life?
Well, I've had this sort of absurdly uncomplicated life. So, no, I don't think I have.
So it's one of the rules for life, but not yours specifically.
No, it is a general principle that I feel we should live by. Does it apply to me? Probably not. I mean, I always say I'm a product of middle-class Southern Ontario in the 1970s. The single most idyllic, boring, disaster-free environment a human being can grow up in.
Yeah, not too many dramas made about 1970s Ontario.
You literally could not find a calmer place on earth in the 1970s. Like, there's just nothing, zero crime, zero social disruption, zero anything except like happy families going to public schools.
So a lot of your work draws lessons and draws story and research out of sports. Mm-hmm. I have tried my whole life to get into watching any sport, mm-hmm. like for any reason. And I cannot, like, I cannot get past this is boring and it is too long. And I don't know why I'm supposed to care. What am I missing?
Well, you might be placing too much emphasis on watching the sport and not enough emphasis on learning and reading about the sport.
Huh.
So I don't watch a lot of basketball. I watch basically playoff basketball, but I read enormous amounts about basketball. I actually follow it through my reading, not through my watching. Similarly, I mean, I watch the sport I really care about is track. There aren't a lot of track meets. I rarely go to one. They're hard to go to. They're real, you know, good ones are all in Europe. I maybe watch two meets or Porsche, a couple of races a year on, you know, obscure websites. Mostly what I do is I read about track, right? And that's how you follow. Same thing, football I tend to watch and not read about. But in the main, the things, there are very few, only golf. Golf is the only sport that I never read about and will happily watch a golf major.
And what are you attached to? Are you attached to, in your reading, are you attached to teams, outcomes, just great literary narratives about sport? I mean, no, what is the nature of your connection?
Basketball is about statistics. It's about that each player can be represented statistically in a number of different ways, and narratives arise out of that statistical representation, and great debates happen. And then basketball is an infinitely complicated kind of mixture, particularly the contemporary NBA. What's interesting about it is almost entirely off the court. It's like player movements, trades, you know, endless kind of dramas. And I mean, it's reality TV. It's not just a sport anymore.
So are you ecumenical in like which teams you're reading about, where you're reading from? Like, you
pretty
don't
much follow it all.
I don't care.
I listen to, you know, I really only listen devotedly to podcasts about sports. I don't really, I sample other things, but the ones I listen to every week are, I mean, it's like Bill Simmons.
I've heard you say very nice things about the Weeds.
I do listen to the Weeds, but you know, Simmons is like three podcasts a week. I mean, just,
you
know,
you could live with Simmons.
You can live with Simmons.
So that's it. So when did that start for you? Did that come out of? Because the thing that I am fascinated by in sports, and this is going to come up in a book I'm writing, is how to build a connection to something where the stakes don't seem high to me.
Wait, what is your book's been very mysterious.
I know.
What's it about?
Sports, clearly.
Are you in a position to talk about it?
Yeah. Book's about polarization, but there's, because it's about polarization around identity, there's a chapter about sports, because sports are a very clear example of the way in which people can construct identity out of what is objectively a low stakes form of material.
Yeah.
The ups and downs of a team composed of players who are only there because they're being paid the most money to be there. And so if you're looking for proof that we can form identities out of things that are quite weak when viewed from an outside perspective, right? They're not our race, they're not our nationality, they're not something that has some kind of deep objective relationship to the way we move through the world. Sports and the incredible passions they can unleash and their incredible prevalence, as far as we know, in every culture around the world, are just like an amazing laboratory case for that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting. So there are a number of different varieties of sports attachments. I suspect what you're focused on are tribal attachments to sports, which, interesting enough, is not the kind. I used to be a tribal sports person. I used to live and die with the Toronto Blue Jays. And then they went through a stretch where they would be the best team in the AL East, and then they would lose tragically to, you know, in the final days of the season. This happened repeatedly, and it proved so painful, I couldn't go on. So in other words, the tribal thing, I tried the tribal thing, and I, for whatever it is, I am not constructed to engage in tribal sports because I can't handle the emotional fallout from disappointment.
That seems rational to me.
Yeah, though I
like, why expose yourself to that emotional fallout?
I miss it, though. I mean, I really regret. I wish I had a consuming sports identity, and now I don't. Now I'm in basketball. I am almost indifferent to. I fall. You know, I'll watch any game. I don't have any strong feelings. I don't live or die when one team loses or another team wins. It's just, I'm sort of interested in the outcome, but not emotionally engaged anymore because I can't handle it.
And so when you follow it, then you're following it as a kind of tableau on which other lessons of life play out?
No, I'm just, I love the game aesthetically. So another form of attachment to sports is the closed universe principle, right? Which is the, it's a very childish response. Kids like worlds where, that like knowable worlds, right? That are finite, that they can master, and that can give them some feeling of control over their lives. You know, there are, you read all the Harry Potter books and you have world mastery. There's X number of them. So I have a very childish, I have a world mastery approach to sports. I feel I can discuss, men's middle distance running with anyone. I mean, there are people who have, more finely grained knowledge, but I can't be lost in that conversation because I have essential mastery of the world of elite men's middle class, middle distance running. That is, I don't cheer for any one runner, but I like the feeling that I can look at any race on that level and know what's going on. That's really the way I think about all sports. But that's not what you're talking about. You're talking about tribal attachments, which are way more interesting.
I like to think so. Or at least I'm hoping other people will think so when they see my book on shelves. What is generous orthodoxy?
Generous orthodoxy, that comes from a podcast episode I did in my first season of Revisionist History. And I was trying to get at a subject which really has always really, really interested me, which is what is the right way to dissent? Because it strikes me there's clearly a wrong way and a right way. It's not clear. So ever since I read Alberto Hirschman's Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, that book is about as important a book as I've ever read in terms of, the sheer kind of elegance of his paradigm. But he was—
For those not familiar with Exit, Voice, Loyalty, because it's so quick to explain, you want to give a capsule?
Yeah. So it's written by a man named Alberto Hirschman, who was Einstein's cousin, crucially, and who grows up in privileged German Jewish Berlin and has the most extraordinary life of like any intellectual. He like fights in the resistance. He rescues other Jews and out of Spain. I mean, just like insane life. And he becomes he's an economist, but he's not a quantitative economist. He's a kind of philosopher economist. And he writes a series of insanely elegant books, one of which is called Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, which is basically saying that there are two, he's interested in two responses to unhappiness with a particular system. One is exit, you leave, and one is loyalty, you stay and you raise your, I'm sorry, one is voice, you stay and you speak up. And one of the things he's interested in that book is that economists have an inherent bias towards exit. They think that's what the market is. And he's like, actually, there are lots of markets that are better served by voice, where you stay put and you try and make the system you're a part of better. And then loyalty is where you keep your mouth shut. Mm-hmm. But that sort of has always fascinated me. So the generous orthodoxy was a podcast episode about a Mennonite minister in his 90s who had a gay son and at the age of 90, what have you, presided over the marriage of his gay son. And in so doing, violated the precepts of his particular branch of the Mennonite Church. And he did this in full knowledge of the fact that he was doing it. He informed his church that he was doing it. As a result, they didn't excommunicate him. They stripped him of his pastoral responsibilities. And he accepted this decision by the church incredibly graciously. And he then wrote a famous letter where he both affirmed his devotion and loyalty to his church, accepted their judgment of his violation of their norms, and begged to differ with the direction they were taking. And it was so gorgeous. And in the theological universe, his approach has been called generous orthodoxy, which means that orthodox is where you are loyal, and generous is where you're willing to accept and entertain opposing viewpoints. And the combination of the two is the sweet spot. Can I be generous even as I'm remaining true to my institution?
There's a funny principle in here, which you do see sometimes about, can you betray an organization, an institution, a set of laws or norms, and instead of demanding it adapt to you, just accept that you've gone against it and accept the judgment, right? You actually see this relatively rarely. There are like very few people, you'll see it in civil disobedience, right? Yeah. Nonviolent protest. But in general, there's a kind of feeling that if I'm right, then that has to be recognized. It's very rare to see somebody just say like, I'm doing this and like, this is going to be the way that the judgment comes down on me. And it's both right for me to do this and reasonable for me to abide by the rules of the game as I understood them. And like, here we go.
Yes, this is why the notion is so appealing, because it does seem out of step with the moment. But there is something lovely about the level of self-sacrifice that's involved in that form of dissent.
So one of the reasons I brought up these two, I know I had a somewhat long digression on sports, but the question of pulling the goalie and generous orthodoxy, is I'm curious how you develop the structure for your stories. Your stories tend to combine a like a story and then kind of a big conceptual frame. And recognizing that in this particular one, the two might have been a little bit more connected, but like in the new book, there's Sandra Bland as the overarching story. What comes first for you? Is it, does it tend to be the tale you're investigating or the framework that you want to come across? Like, how do you structure your investigations?
Well, it's changed. It began, I think, way back when I would start with the idea. So when I wrote Tipping Point, I literally was in the library one day and read a paper in the American Journal of Sociology about the idea of using epidemiological theory to understand social processes. You know, so it begins with a theory, and I think, oh, let's think about how that applies to, and then I just sort of came up with examples. These days, I tend to do it the opposite way. I think as a function of, you know, my doing the podcast for 4 years, Originist History for 4 years now, has just completely altered the way I do journalism. I'm sort of become unrecognizable to myself, maybe not to the world, but... And that is all about story. You find the story, and more than that, you find the tape. Then you find a story within the tape, and then you think about, well, I want people to listen to this person, and now I need to give them a reason why. Like there was a podcast episode. Sometimes it doesn't quite work. Like there was an episode last year, last season, about the differences between Israeli chutzpah and American chutzpah. And that's really all of that was because of two things. I went to LA and I met this movie producer called Al Ruddy, who's in his 90s. He was the producer of The Godfather and Hogan's Heroes, among other things. And he was just hilarious. And I had 3 hours of tape of him telling war stories from essentially the 70s, 60s.
How did that meeting come about?
I was interested in, for some reason, there was a case, all this fell away, but there was a case in Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania. One of the school trustees was forced to resign because someone had discovered that at a costume party when he was at Gettysburg in the 1970s, he had dressed up as Colonel Klink from Hogan's Heroes. Now, for those who are too young to remember Hogan's Heroes, it was a sitcom in the late 60s that was set in a German prison of war camp. And
it's a very strange show to describe.
It's almost impossible to describe.
Like, if you describe Hogan's Heroes to people, they will not believe this was a show.
No. It doesn't make any... It has no... It could never work in a million years today. But literally, the star of the show were the two German officers, Colonel Schultz and... You know, Colonel Klink and Sergeant Schultz. And Sergeant Schultz, in the genius of this show, is that Sergeant Schultz was an idiot, and he went around saying things like, I know nothing, I see nothing, which as a kind of allegory for a German, as a kind of joke, not joke, but a kind of, you know, essential truth of a German soldier in the Second World War. So originally I wanted to talk about, so this was a show that was written and conceived by two Jewish guys. All of the principal actors, including the Nazis, were Jews. And it was greenlit by the Jewish head of ABC, or CBS, rather. Everyone was Jewish, and they were doing a comedy set in a German prisoner of war camp. So, like, I just thought this was fantastic. And I originally thought, oh, what the interesting thing here is, it's a story about the Holocaust and how the kind of fascinating fact about the Holocaust is that no one talked about it in any kind of determined, principled way, public way, until sort of late 70s, early 80s. There's a famous book written about this fact, about how long it took for us to come to terms with the memory of the Holocaust. So in this kind of interregnum, when we're not talking
just so I understand, not here that it wasn't known that there was mass killing of Jews, but the idea that it was constructed as a singular, phenomenon. Like, totalizing event. That like, the narrative of it was not built.
So, you know, there's an extraordinary book written by a historian at, I forget where, in the 70s on this, or 80s, where she talks about how an entire generation of Jewish Americans, for example, grew up in homes where the Holocaust just did not come up. Even if their parents were somehow Holocaust survivors, it wasn't taught in schools. It was known, but not discussed as a kind of entity. And then all that changes with Shoah, with Schindler's List, with the rise of Holocaust museums. But that's all a phenomenon that happens 40 years after the war's over. And so in this period where this kind of weird interregnum, there is this sitcom done by Jews in which Jewish actors play Nazi soldiers and they make fun of, it's not a concentration camp, it's a prisoner of war camp, nonetheless. So I just thought this was fascinating. So the guy who conceived Hogan's Heroes is still alive. His name is Al Ruddy. And I went to see Al Ruddy. He's now 90 some odd years. And then we spoke for 3 hours and I quickly realized that Hogan's Heroes was only one of 19 interesting things about his life. And actually the Holocaust story wasn't the most interesting thing, or I couldn't make it work somehow. And then I thought, well, if I talk to Steven Spielberg, I could make it. But then Steven Spielberg wouldn't talk to me. And so I was like, huh, what should I do? But, you know, and then I kind of cast about, and the whole thing that was driving it is I wanted people to hear the tape of this guy already because he was just so hilarious and profane, and his memory stories were so incredible. I wanted any kind of vessel to tell a story. And so I came up with this sort of absurd little riff on chutzpah versus chutzpah. And that was the piece. So, but that's a classic example of like, you lead with, I have these stories, I want to tell them. And then you hunt for a reason. Because you can't just run the interview with Al Ruddy, right? It didn't work. You need to have people going to say.
You know how I do these, right? How? You know what's going to, I'm just going to run this interview. Not going to do anything with it at all. And that's why you're number one in the charts.
Well, I'm doing something profoundly different. Yeah. There's an expectation in my audience. I'm going to tell them, I'm going to give them a reason why, and I have to satisfy that expectation. But
this is the thing I've wondered about your move to revisionist history. So your books have always had an organizing theme with a lot of stories in them.
Yeah.
But revisionist history, while there will sometimes be a theme for a couple episodes or something, the need to come up with a new thematic for every episode that tells stories within it, it just seems like an incredible amount of story churn. And I'm very curious how you find this many stories to churn through, like what that operation is like, how you're vetting them. Mm-hmm. I can imagine how you start with something like The Tipping Point and then you begin thinking of examples that would flesh out different parts of it. But for the most part, revisionist history, it's a lot more self-contained, which seems to me like it would actually be a lot harder. Or am I wrong about that?
Yeah, it's super hard. Although, I don't find it hard to come up with the kind of accompanying moral. It's hard to come up with a story. Coming up with 10 original stories every year is super hard.
Do you do that on your own, or do you have like a group of people who are—
I do that on my own, yeah.
How? Like, what is your— are you just wandering through the world with your ears open?
I have in my bag a little green notepad in which I scribble down ideas. I've got like 8 of them there. I can, you know, how many of them will pan out? Very few of them, but in various places I've written, you know, I see something and I think, I can't give it away sadly, but I was reading this memoir of someone who knew Adolf Hitler in the 30s in Berlin, in Munich. In the middle of this memoir, there's a 2-paragraph story that is so deeply hilarious and brilliant and kind of weirdly chilling. And so I read it and literally put the book down and just like, was like, holy shit. And then I hadn't even finished the book. This is like months ago. because I was like, I know it's a story that's really fantastic, but it's really small. I can tell you the story, and I'm not going to, but I could tell you the story in a minute. But now all I've been thinking about since is there a way to turn it into an entire episode? And there must be a way. I just haven't figured it out yet. But, and also, I got to find tape. So I need to, the guy who told the story, I need to scour every available database to find out whether before he died, and I think he dies in his 60s, whether he gave, I just need his voice. It doesn't matter. You have to talk.
How would you find that?
Well, I mean, you start hunting. Like, you know, there's all these news databases around the world, and you have to kind of like systematically call them up, go through them. I mean, we will hunt. You'd be amazed how much audio is out there.
Actually, we do a Netflix show, and I'm just amazed at what we're able to find for it.
Yeah.
Like, it is true that the amount of audio out there is bigger than you would think.
Mm-hmm. I would put the odds of me being able to find something with his voice on it at 50%. And if I could find that, then I just have to come up with the, I need 40 minutes to set up the story. But it's such a great story. And if you tell it right, it would totally work. But that's the kind of thing.
You're a hard cases make bad law guy. I've heard you say that before.
I am, yeah.
How do you feel about Holocaust and World War II storytelling, trying to extract knowledge out of that kind of distilled moment of terror and evil and mass genocide?
Yeah, super. It's not a... I mean, that's why I would never do something that was... I would be, frankly, intimidated to do something that was squarely about the Holocaust. It's too overwhelming. This story is a little whimsical side story. Whimsical to the extent you can be whimsical about Hitler. It is weirdly whimsical about Hitler. And it reflects not on Hitler, but on us. That's why it's a great story. But my preferred stories, particularly for the podcast, are small ones. Mm-hmm. What I like is teasing out the significance of a otherwise seemingly trivial event. Or at least turning something that seemed really unmemorable into something big and kind of meaty.
That's interesting because in the book, I almost want to put a pin in this because I wanted to say something else first, but you almost do the opposite.
Yeah.
You're taking very big, very controversial stories in the book and almost trying to make them smaller.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's true. In that sense, the book is it's an unusual book for me in many ways. It was a fascinating book to write because I hadn't written a book like that before. And it has the kind of range of stories told in the book is quite large. And I think it's probably a more polarizing book than the ones I've written in the past.
Let me say one thing on the Holocaust question, and then let's talk about the book for a bit, because I think these will actually connect. So I went through a period a couple years back of reading a bunch of Holocaust-era memoirs.
Yeah.
And in particular, I was reading memoirs and pieces and books about the era of Hitler's rise. Like Eric Larson has a great book of this nature.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever read or come across a book, They Thought They Were Free. It's a remarkable book about basically just like ordinary supporters of the Nazi party in that era. Mm-hmm. Like, what was it like to just be a voter for the National Socialists? Mm-hmm. And I had to stop at a point because the first thing that I felt was happening was when you look at that, you can just see too many analogies. Like, it all looks too familiar. And then it flips at a juncture and you realize the reason it looks too familiar is that nothing psychologically all that unusual was going on. That for most people who were supporting the Nazi party at that time, they just either talked themselves out of what was going on or didn't know, or it was all completely banal except for what was happening. Like people were just operating in a normal person way. And it was too much to look at frontally for me, right? Yeah. That people could just have a normal life amidst this kind of horror was too much for me to stare in the face. And I couldn't tell whether or not there was like too much lesson to draw from that or almost none. It just meant that people are just people in all kinds of both banal and extreme circumstances. And I had thought about writing something and I just never did because I can never figure out if what I was seeing there was something really important or something really just unimportant. There's just humans doing human things. I guess that isn't so much a question as it is a, it's why I brought up the question of finding stories in there, because that issue of looking to the most extreme examples of things for the lessons that can inform the rest seems both, it's like a particularly compelling storytelling tactic and also feels to me like it can be quite, quite misleading, certainly in terms of how close it makes it seem to barbarism at all times.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think it's funny because doing revisionist history has made me think a lot about that. That's why I always prefer to go small. And I feel like the most successful episodes of revisionist history are very tightly constrained, like, you know, the one about Elvis singing "Are You Lonesome Tonight?" and why does he always stumble over the soliloquy in the middle of "Are You Lonesome Tonight?" Yeah, you know, and it's all about very, very specific examples of parapraxis in action and the way in which our traumas disable our ability to perform. But it's the whole show is structured around three performances of the same song. Casey Bowles, Jack White, and Elvis Presley. Really, so it's tightly limited. It's not about anything else. It's about, you know, it sheds light on it, but it's the kind of focus of the storytelling never leaves "Are You Lonesome Tonight?" I mean, very, very briefly. That I'm very, very comfortable with and feel I know how to tell a compelling radio story there. And for audio, the smallness aids in the effectiveness of it, right? It's really hard to do sweeping stories on audio, I think, because the medium is so emotional. That why would you, when you do these sweeping stories, you're giving up the strongest thing about the medium, which is the ability to touch people in a very kind of personal, emotional, intimate level. But with this book, you know, I guess I do in some cases, yeah, there's some, like, there are some chapters that go very, very broad and extreme.
Support for The Gray Area comes from Mint Mobile. When you hear secret sauce, maybe you think of the mysterious ingredient in your favorite burger. Or perhaps it's your grandmother's terrifying meatloaf, which somehow seemed to secrete sauce. But from now on, when you hear secret sauce, I want you to think about Mint Mobile. Their secret is that they only sell wireless service online. That means they can cut the cost of retail stores and pass those savings directly to you. By switching to Mint Mobile, you can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/gray area. That's mintmobile.com/gray area. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/gray area. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Support for this show comes from NetSuite. All too often, people like the owl monkey and the Australian sea lion only see the world in black or white. Now, regular listeners of this podcast, who are mostly humans, understand that the world is more complicated than that. There's also plenty of gray areas. The world of business is a great example. See what I did there? An S&P 500 company and a small business owner have to see things differently, which is why NetSuite wants to provide products and services tailor-made for any business. NetSuite is a top-rated cloud financial system that brings accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into a single platform. NetSuite lives in the cloud, which can reduce IT costs and can improve efficiency and cut back on mistakes by bringing all your major business processes into one platform. NetSuite says that more than 37,000 companies have already made the move. Maybe it's time you did the same. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. You can head to netsuite.com/gray area. netsuite.com/gray area. netsuite.com/gray area.
So the book opens with a story and closes with the story of Sandra Bland. Who was arrested for largely, I would say, no reason. and committed suicide in jail. Mm-hmm. And it's a horrifying story. And I guess the first question, Ed, did the book start with the story of Sandra Bland, or did the book start with a desire to investigate interpersonal contact and misunderstanding and trying to like read each other across divides and come to settle on the Sandra mm-hmm. Bland story as the primary lens of perspective?
Well, I had been rooting around for a couple of years. I had been playing with a couple of ideas. So I had, there's a story in the beginning of the book, I tell that spy story involving Florentino Aspiaga and the legendary CIA operative known as the Mountain Climber. I had stumbled across that story some time ago.
Can you capsule that story?
Yeah, so that's a story about a Cuban defector in 1987 who was high up in the Cuban intelligence service and goes to the CIA and basically reveals to them that every single member of the CIA's network of spies in Cuba was a double agent working for Castro. So that we had been
completely wild.
Not just once, not just twice, but 48 times. And we had fooled one of the most legendary of CIA operatives, this man called the Mountain Climber. And so I tell this sort of dramatic story about how the CIA learns that they're, you know, the most savviest, most sophisticated intelligence agency in the world was like literally, you know, played for a song by Fidel Castro. And then I tell, then follow that up with a second spy story afterwards. But I was sort of into those spy stories. I didn't know what to do with them, but I was very interested in this question of why are we so easily deceived? And that's when I ran across the work of Tim Levine at University of Alabama. And that provided, I gave a talk at the neuroscience society in New York in like 2015 or something like that, where I like talked about Levine's work and Madoff, which is another example of the same thing.
How did you, when you say you ran across Levine's work, how did you run across Levine's work?
I remember I found it online. I was reading.
You're like Google scholaring, like no, why no. are we so easily deceived?
I was working through, I have always been fascinated by this, and as have many, many psychologists. There's this fundamental fact which has baffled people for generations, which is, why are we so bad at detecting lies? We should be good, you would think. We're uniformly terrible. If I bring 100 people before you and each of them says something, and when some of them are telling the lies and some of them are telling the truth, you will probably be 50, and I ask you to spot the liars, mm-hmm. your accuracy rate will be 52, 53, 54%, slightly better than chance. That's true of all of us, vanishingly few exceptions. That's really, really puzzling. And tons of people have taken a run at explaining why this would be so, why we would be terrible at something that seems so fundamental. And I just ran across, Levine has tackled this himself, and I just thought his answer was the best. And he has this whole theory about how we are not, contrary to expectation, evolution has not selected us for our ability to read strangers correctly. It's selected us for our ability to do the opposite, to implicitly trust communication, and that we have, human society is built on a trade-off, that the benefits of trusting everyone are so great that we can bear the occasional downside of being deceived. And because deception is relatively rare, it's a good deal. And I just loved, his work is fascinating. This book, it's like a hymn. The first half of it is a hymn to Tim Levine. I mean, really, mm-hmm. There's a real elegance and beauty to his explanation of this problem. And I was just I kind of fell in love with his ideas.
And so did his work come before you found the Sandra Bland?
Yeah, I was reading
found,
it
before that was
even the Sandra Bland case.
Yeah,
I was reading this stuff. And then, but I didn't know what to do with it. And I didn't think I wanted to write a book about deception. That seemed to be not a good book. I needed something. And then Sandra Bland came along and I thought, that's a chapter in the book. And then very quickly I realized, no. That's everything I want to talk about. That's actually, and I read a book by Frank Zimring at Berkeley called Why Police Kill, which really, 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 really also got me going, because one of the first times I've seen a scholar of his magnitude, he's as big a criminologist as exists, really take the question of police violence seriously in that way and try and quantify how many people are killed. By the way, it's really hard. He spends the first third of the book trying to figure out what the number is. I mean, it's insane that we don't have, you can't go on a database and see, oh, that's the number. You have to kind of sort it together. What's the number? Second third of the book is that high or low relative to other countries? And third answer is why. The answer to that is it's high. Third answer is why. Third part of the book is why. And that sort of made me realize this is super interesting. And oddly, despite the fact we were obsessed with all those cases from Ferguson on down, it's oddly an unaddressed issue. The history of race in LA is the history of police stops gone awry. That's Watts. That's Eula Love. That's Rodney King. I mean, I could literally tell an entire narrative about LA that is all about white cops confronting African Americans, right? And every time the city collapses in some kind of catastrophe, there's one of these incidents at the core. I mean, Watts begins with a cop pulling over an African American kid on a DWI, and an argument ensues between the guy's mom and the cop. That's Watts, right? And then people don't remember Eula Love, but Eula Love was the Ferguson of its day. I mean, it was a huge deal in LA. It's where Maxine Waters comes from. Maxine Waters is a product of Eula Love, right? She was the young unknown assembly person, or maybe she was even on the city council, who makes her name taking on the establishment over the death of this African-American woman at the hands of police officers. It's like fascinating to think of, you know, Los Angeles has been profoundly shaped by these, and they're all the same. These incidents, they're all the same. They're just versions of the same fundamental problem.
So what's the connection, you saw here? Because if you're listening to this conversation, the connection between CIA operative gets fooled, trust is not something, or mistrust actually is not something we were evolutionarily selected for.
Yeah.
And then police stops. Like racially charged and tragic police stops. Like what is the connection you saw there?
Two connections. One is that fundamentally the CIA problem issue is that we are really, really bad at, and I expand on this in the book, at reading strangers. The tools that I use to make sense of people in my intimate circle who I have long a history with are not useful with strangers. When I only have 2 minutes to make sense of you, I generally do a very bad job and I draw inferences from things that I shouldn't draw inferences from. That means that high stakes encounters between strangers are inherently problematic. Well, what is policing? It is high stakes encounters between strangers, right? Secondarily, as we get into the book, I talk about in an attempt to improve policing in this country in the last generation, we have retrained police officers to stop defaulting to truth, to stop being sort of trust machines. We've instructed them to violate their evolutionary predisposition to trust people. And that has made the problem of working with strangers even worse.
What do you mean by that? We've instructed them to violate that programming.
So the last third of the book is all about a philosophy of policing that rises up in the 1980s. And it's where, you know, we've gone from a situation in this country where the number of discreet, used to be the case that a police officer was someone who responded to obvious infractions of the law. You're speeding, you ran a red light, those kinds of things. Or, you know, a traffic accident or a crime happens and the policeman is called to the scene and resolves something that has already happened. That was policing in America through the 1980s. In the 1980s, there is a fundamental shift, and police begin to realize for the first time that they can be proactive, that by acting aggressively, they can stop crimes from actually happening. Believe it or not, the police did not think they were capable of doing that up to that point. There's an incredible interview in the Harvard Business Review with the chief of police of the NYPD. I think it's in the late 80s. A very, very distinguished police officer who went on to be mayor of some big American city. And he talks about it. He's like, we can't stop crime. Like, that's not what we do, right? You want to stop, here's the whole thing. You want to stop crime, you've got to like build schools and alleviate poverty. That's not our job. Our job is to respond to crimes and resolve them in some way, like arrest the people who are. It was incredible. It's like, you read this today, you're like, what? Like, the chief of the largest police force, domestic police force, probably in the world, was essentially saying in a highly respected public forum, I can't do anything about the thing I'm supposed to do something about, right? Don't, like, it's busy. What are you looking at me for? Like, you want to solve crime? Go elsewhere. And that dramatically shifts as a result of a number of things. And I have a whole chapter on one of the key events in that shift is what's called the Kansas City experiment. And the Kansas City experiment was conducted in one of the worst neighborhoods in Kansas City, where they decided to flip the switch and put in a group of dedicated police officers to go in and basically stop anyone who looked even remotely suspicious and try and hunt for guns, try and get guns off the street. And it's spectacularly successful. And in a kind of, the switch is flipped. And all of a sudden, all around the United States, law enforcement people are like, oh, you mean we can go out there and proactively and aggressively stop crimes before they happen by identifying bad guys in locking them up or taking away their guns or what have you. And that the whole era that we're in now is a result of that. So now, if you look at the number of police stops that are done by an average highway patrol officer in the United States, they're up like, I mean, I've forgotten the exact number, but we're talking about 2, 3, 4, 5x greater than they used to be. I mean, the era we're in now where there's an astonishing number of what are called discretionary stops every day on the road in America. That's new. And that is the context in which Brian Encinia, the police officer in the Sandra Bland case, stops Sandra Bland. She's a discretionary stop. And that's what he did for a living. That's what he was trained to do. And the engine of the discretionary stop is to train police officers not to behave as human beings and think the best of the intentions of those around them, but to behave as some kind of mutant form of human. And it encourages them to construct paranoid fantasies about the world in which they're operating in. And Brian Encinia constructs a paranoid fantasy about Sandra Bland. That is the beginning, that is the opening assumption that drives that deeply problematic encounter. And the reason to tell that story is because it's not a one-off. It's what he did every day as a police officer, and it is what tens of thousands of other police officers do every day because of a very deliberate and explicit shift in law enforcement strategy over the last generation.
So one of the divides the book gets into, early on you say that there's been, on the one hand, a left narrative about this, which is about race, and a right narrative about it, which is just about individual police and a kind of micro level and like, were they, did they feel under threat at that exact moment?
Yeah.
And to hold on the left narrative of it for a minute, I think the view that a lot of this is about race is that when you call it a paranoid fantasy, when you talk about the mistrust, that is where at least some of it is coming from, that it's much easier to mistrust, to misread across race and particularly across stereotypes of African-Americans.
Yeah, no, that's totally true. Yeah. I mean, I think race is at the center of the Sandra Bland case. If she's white, she doesn't get stopped, right? She gets stopped because she has out-of-state plates, because she's a young black woman, because she's driving a Hyundai. Like that. Change any one of those facts, her odds of being stopped.
A Hyundai?
Yeah, she's driving a Mercedes. She doesn't get stopped.
Not fair.
Right? So, yeah, I don't mean to, it's not that race is irrelevant. My problem is—
Well, I'm not actually saying that you're saying it's irrelevant. I'm more actually asking the empirical question there, that across races, does this kind of mismatch, does this kind of translation problem that you're addressing, does it get worse, right? Does it aid in the construction of paranoid fantasy? Certainly it seems to aid in the perception of threat.
Yeah, I think it does. So Encinia, in his deposition in the investigation, explains his behavior by saying that he thought that Sandra Bland was behaving in a threatening manner. He thought that she was going to pull a gun on him or something like that. I think that is very much about first of all, was nonsense. There's nothing going to be further than the truth. But that is a very common manifestation of a fundamentally racist impulse, right? That's one of the ways racism is manifested, is to turn the harmless into the threatening. And he very much does that. That being said, there's an incredible moment in the deposition where he's asked, what do you say to those who say you stopped her because she was black? And he says something to the effect of, we stop everybody. And if you look at his record as a police officer, I mean, the man made so many discretionary stops. It's kind of true. Like, he did stop everybody. It's astonishing. We have a record of every single police stop he made in his career as an officer. And if you put that alongside the stops of an officer 25 years ago, there's just no comparison. I mean, he is like, I mean, I think I've forgotten the exact number, but in the hour before he stops Sandra Bland, he stops like three other people, all for the same bullshit reasons. Like, light above your license plate is out. You know, these kind of like, no one's speeding. No one's running red lights. No one is like drunk. It's all this ticky-tacky bullshit, but that's what he was trained to do. You stop them on the ticky-tacky bullshit because you're looking for something else. You think,
or
that
as in Ferguson,
be.
It's become a revenue strategy.
Or as in Ferguson, it's becoming exactly a revenue strategy. Yeah, and I suspect that's actually a much bigger, that plays a much bigger role in a lot of this than is usually recognized.
This seems to me like a pretty broad-based indictment of how we police. There's often, when you get into these kinds of conversations, a sort of a throwback narrative of, we used to have the cop on the beat and he or she was more involved in the community and talking to people and not having these not all the interactions were hostile by nature, right? More of the interactions were like checking in with the neighborhood laundromat, like, how are things going today, Teddy? Is that part of your conclusion in this, that we've developed a form of policing that is leading to increased paranoia and hostility and defensiveness among people who carry firearms? And like, that's probably a bad way to structure that relationship, both for them and for the communities that mm-hmm. they serve?
Yeah. So there's a bunch of things here that are, I think, worthy to note. One is that in Sinia's deposition, he talks about how he was scared of Sandra Bland. And there are many people who say, oh, he's just saying that to justify what some really bad policing. I think that's false. That one of the things that I've observed from interviewing police officers and reading in this sort of general literature is they are understandably terrified in these cases because they are living with the consequences of a society that has a ton of guns. So if you're in Canada or Germany in this exact same situation, you're not scared. Why? Because the odds that the person behind the wheel has a gun are vanishingly small. In fact, there was a famous case in Canada of a guy who runs, it's like 2 years ago, or in downtown Toronto, where the guy drives his car up on the sidewalk and runs down all these people, and the cop gets out of his car, and the cop has a gun on him, and the guy is like fumbling in his pockets, and the cop doesn't shoot him. In America, he would have shot him. He doesn't in Canada, because in Canada, if you're a cop, you're not living under this. There's just so few handguns. You don't have a presumption that the bad guy's got a gun. In Texas, law enforcement officers live under the actually kind of real fear that there are so many guns out there that chances are they may run into them on the beat, right? So this is yet another way in which this country's inability to deal with its gun problem has unintended consequences. One of the unintended consequences is that police behave very differently in a country awash in guns than they do in a country without handguns, right? So that's point number one about the broader context. And the second point I was making is that replay the encounter between Sandra Bland and Brian Encinia, where she's not an outsider. So weirdly,
what do you mean by outsider here?
She's from Prairie View, Texas. So they're the same age. They're both 28, I believe. So if she had been from Prairie View and he'd been from Prairie View, they would have gone to high school together. They probably would have known each other, right? Now, all of a sudden, if they know each other, there's almost, I think, no chance the encounter unfolds the way it does. Because he says, when he stops her and rolls down the window, he's like, oh, it's Sandy Bland, right? And they don't have to like each other, but all of a sudden they have a way of relating to each other that is outside of the prism of powerful cop with a gun, you know, helpless outsider in the car. And the thing about familiarity in community is it gives you multiple points of connection with someone. You know, when I was a kid, I can remember being pulled over by the police chief in our town, and he was someone my family had known for 15 years. I knew his kids, went to school with him. His family went to the same church as us. He lived down the street, right? I had five ways to relate to him. And so I didn't even relate to him as a police officer. I related to him as a guy who would call my mom if I didn't behave, right? Whole different encounter in under those circumstances. So in a certain sense, in situations where we are all strangers and you don't have those additional forms of identification, these situations become inherently problematic. And that's why you don't need an overarching rethinking of police strategy if it's all small town cops, right? I mean, small town cops have other problems, but you do when you have the cop and he has only one way to relate to the woman in the car and vice versa. And that is in their role as civilian pulled over for a bullshit reason and man with a gun.
But there's a section of the book, and I thought this was both interesting and complicated for that kind of overarching story, where you argue that actually knowing people better does not often help us read them better.
Superficially better.
Sure. But if it is fair that like you knew that police officer much more deeply. Mm. But if Sandra Bland and the officer who arrested her had kind of some superficial contact, they lived in the same town. She was 3 years under him in high school. I recognize they were the same age in reality, but most people will not actually know each other in high school. That I was surprised by how little that seemed to do.
Yeah.
And not only was I surprised by how little that seemed to do, but to actually take it maybe out of this specific case, I actually thought that that section was more of a problem for journalists than we like to give credit for.
Oh,
I think like when you're profiling someone.
Oh, you can't. The profile is morally bankrupt, intellectually bankrupt.
I kind of agree with that.
I mean, but Jenna Malcolm.
And I say that as somebody who like assigns and personally does profiles. But the idea that we can know people by, I always think that we way underrate reading people's books and reading their public speeches. We seem to think that the impression we will get of them, like having lunch, is more authentic than the impression they're trying to put out to the world.
Yeah.
But yes, to that point that a lot of how we know people is relatively superficial. And we expect that gives us a very big bump over not knowing them at all. And that part of the book suggests maybe not.
Yeah. So like the issue there is in relatively brief and casual encounters, face-to-face encounters, what is the value of the marginal information that's gathered? And the answer is it is somewhere between small and of negative value, or somewhere between zero and negative. It is not clear it's additive. Now, after a certain point, it does become additive. I mean, if I knew you, if I saw you every day for a year, then the information I've gathered over that year is very useful. It's really a question of if I sat down with you for 1 hour, would I be able to make meaningful inferences about who you are on the basis of that? And the answer is, I would say, is absolutely not. In fact, if I'm trying to understand how Ezra thinks, I would be better off foregoing the 1 hour interview and just spending that hour reading, that extra time reading things that you have written or said.
And how much of this is that in the 1 hour interview, and like one of the big examples used in that area, in that area is Hitler and Chamberlain, right?
Yeah.
So that's even a better example of what I'm talking about than the 1 hour interview. But that there is a, if we sat down for a 1 hour interview and you're profiling me, I would be performing for you.
Yes.
Right? I would never let my guard down.
Yeah.
Right? I would have like a version of myself I wanted you to see. Mm-hmm. And obviously Hitler had a version of himself he wanted Chamberlain to see, to go to our discussion actually about Nazi and World War II analogies and stories. How much is that, like how much is the, is it that superficial contact isn't useful, or that the kinds of superficial contact we're measuring, or just in superficial contact we are performing and it takes time to drop that?
I think it's versions of all those things. So there is the performance problem. So I'm altering my presentation. But there is also the noisy data, irrelevant and a noisy data problem, which is that, so I'm in a face-to-face encounter with you and I'm gathering all kinds of information about you that is utterly irrelevant, but I don't appropriately discount it. So, you know, what if I think your shoes are?
You know, it's so funny. You're looking down at my shoes. I did this interview with Michael Lewis a couple months ago, and it was a great interview. But I was asking him to sort of read me like he would a profile character. And he immediately fastened in on my socks, which at that point were like gray socks with avocados on them. He's like, well, you're wearing these loud socks. And I just had not done laundry for a while because home life is nuts. And but he couldn't tell if there was a difference between I was trying to make a statement versus I have not done laundry.
you can't. I mean, and the profilist always assumes you're making a statement.
Yeah.
As opposed to discounting. But I don't, you know, there's the potential for screwing it up. It's really about inappropriate weights given to various kinds of data. And this is the observation that all those, you know, people like Tetlock and the people who study forecasting, they're always coming back to the fact that we are it's really hard for human beings to assign appropriate weights to data. Some stuff is worth 10x more than other stuff, but when we rank all the variables, we tend to assume they're all equal, right? Or some version of that problem. When you meet someone, you're gathering stuff that is of vanishingly small importance, and yet it's impossible to put it in its proper perspective. If you are attractive and articulate and charming, it may be all those things may be incredibly irrelevant to what I'm trying to get from the encounter, but I cannot put them out of my head. So under those circumstances, don't meet them.
You know, someone you're making me think of, I profiled John Edwards when he was running for president in 2008. And I had been, previous to that, invited over to John and Elizabeth Edwards' house for dinner because Elizabeth Edwards, who's a wonderful woman in my experience, had read my blog. Mm-hmm. And so I had seen them together. And I come from a divorced family. All of my friends were divorced families, and they just seemed like the most loving together couple. Like her hair was growing back from cancer treatments, and he was so doting and sweet. And in their book, they talk about how they raise their children. And among the things I just thought about John Edwards and Elizabeth Edwards is such a charismatic, like powerful figure, was that like, well, at the very, like he has this incredibly grounding family life, right? With this partner who's really his equal, and in some ways I found much more compelling than I found him. And then when the story began to come out that he had a love child, I mean, this was a crazy level of deception that he ended up undergoing. But I heard from the campaign, no, it's his body man, you know, who, you know, is the father of the child. I was like, well, okay, like that. And then when it all really did come out, it's like, my God. I mean, I didn't really cover necessarily that part of it. So it's not like I made some huge journalistic error here, but just in terms of reading that family, I was either wrong or just the multitudes people can hold are so big that it's not even clear what it would mean to be right. It's just, I've kind of always held that one. It's like, yeah, you can really get that wrong.
I was going to say, Jenna Malcolm has a piece in the current New Yorker. I think it's called The Perils of Biography. It's all about the Susan Sontag biography. And she, you know, she previously had written about the biographer's dilemma with his or her subject. And in this case, though, she's interested in the dilemma of how, as a biographer, when you go and you interview all the people who knew the subject, how you insufficiently take into consideration their agendas. Mm-hmm. And it's even more interesting. I mean, at a certain point, you're like, you know what? She's right. We should just give up on biographies, which is also hilarious because no one has written more brilliant biographies than Jenna Malcolm, right? Like, but although the thing about her biographies is they are, the one thing I will say, she does take her own lessons to heart, and they're incredibly narrow. So she's interested in making very, very specific points about the people that she's, I just read her, actually when I was writing this book, because I had the thing about Sylvia Plath, I read her book on, I've forgotten what it's called, about on Sylvia Plath. And it's a work of complete and utter genius. But it's like, it does not resolve broader questions about, she realizes she can't do that. She's interested in giving you a little tiny insight into the relationship between Ted Hughes, particularly Ted Hughes's estate, and Sylvia Plath.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline, because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.
I want to go back for a second to the misweighting of information, because one of the stories you tell in the book that I thought was really compelling was the story of Amanda Knox, because I've always just been utterly fascinated by that case and what happened there. So can you kind of give the sort of high-level version of the Amanda Knox case and sort of what your ultimate conclusion on it was?
So Levine, the researcher whose work I use a lot in this book, has this idea of he's trying to explain. First, he tries to explain why we're bad at detecting lies. And then he goes a step further and he says, there's a further wrinkle in this. And that is, there are some people who we all get right and some people who we all get wrong. In other words, it's not we're not randomly wrong when it comes to detecting dissection. There are the very, very broad, consistent patterns. And there are, so literally, if you have 100 people, all of whom are either lying or telling the truth, there are about, I don't know what the exact numbers are, but let's say for the sake of argument, there are 50 of those people who we all know with 100% certainty if they are lying or telling the truth. Those are people he calls matched. They are people whose internal emotional states are perfectly represented in their facial expressions and emotions. So in those cases, the liars are stammering and blushing and looking away, and the truth tellers are looking you right in the eye and radiating sincerity and honesty and modesty. The problem comes with unmatched people, and unmatched people are the opposite. They are people who manifest the symptoms of a liar, but they're not lying, or who are like Bernie Madoff. They seem 100% high integrity, honest, and they're like sociopathic Ponzi schemers. And we all get unmatched people wrong. Even experts like FBI agents, and he did tests with people who ought to be good at this. And FBI agents are better than us only at matched people. They get them absolutely perfect. But on unmatched people, they're as bad, if not worse, than the rest of us. I mean, so the unmatched people, and they're a fairly significant percentage of the population, present huge problems for individual kind of decoding. And Amanda Knox is classically unmatched. I mean—
So the Amanda Knox story.
The Amanda Knox story is if you'll remember, the American teenager who does a year abroad in Italy, and within weeks of her arrival in Perugia, her roommate is brutally murdered, and she quickly falls under suspicion and is convicted and wrongfully convicted and spends 4 years in Italian prison until she's freed. And the question is, why did people think that a super, you know, ordinary middle-class girl from Seattle would have been complicit in a heinous, you know, murder? And the answer is that she's mismatched. She's someone who, she did not represent her grief and distress in a way that those around her expected grief and distress to be manifested. And because of that, they concluded she must be lying and hiding a terrible truth that she had, you know, bludgeoned her roommate to death. And I would argue that, by the way, Sandra Bland was a little bit mismatched as well, that she was manifesting her distress in a way that the police officer thought was threatening behavior. And distress and malice, two very, very, very different states. And he looked at her being jittery and nervous and trying desperately to calm herself down. And he read it as, she's got a gun. She's going to hurt me. Had she been weeping silently, he would have behaved very differently. But that's not, she's, you know, no fault of her own. She's just not someone who manifested her distress in that way.
So one of the big picture points of the book, and you were saying earlier that you felt this one was like a more polarizing book, and I think it's for this, that is that we should be much more forgiving of people who get fooled, who come into contact or are the boss of, or are nearby to, some kind of liar, sociopath, trickster, deceiver, and don't see it because they're just normal people who trust that somebody is not fooling them or us. And there's this deep desire for justice in the aftermath of heinous crimes. I mean, you talk about the Paterno case a bit in the book. And that seems to be a place where I think in everyday life, people are relatively open to this, right? Oh, you couldn't possibly have known he was cheating on you, right? You couldn't possibly have known that he was embezzling or that she was. But when it comes to positions of authority, somehow I think implicitly we expect that one thing that a position of authority has is responsibility for getting the people around them and particularly under them right. And we don't seem to me to be in a very forgiving time in this country. It's not a forgiving mood. So I'm curious how you think about that big meta point, that like kind of push for recognizing that there's a reason maybe we get some of these things wrong. And if that doesn't excuse it, that should help us contextualize it.
Yeah. Agreed. The book is, that is really where I'm headed, that I think we need to be more forgiving. And the notion that our leaders ought to be an exception to this, that they have a responsibility to kind of see into the hearts of those under their jurisdiction, I find nonsensical. In fact, I would say the opposite, that it is even more important for our leaders to be trusting in. Because what we really want, like with Graham Spanier, he was the president of Penn State, who was at the time when Jerry Sandusky was arrested and convicted of pedophilia. The president of the University of Penn State was a man named Graham Spanier. And after the prosecutors put Sandusky behind bars, they went after Spanier and they forced his resignation. And then he spent the last, God knows how many years, five, 6 years fighting, basically trying to stay out of jail. And I find my chapter is all about, I don't understand why we went after Spanier. Spanier was, I've met him on several occasions, even before, I met him before the Sandusky case. The man was probably the best president Penn State ever had. And he is good precisely because he is the kind of person who can create, who created a real intellectual community out of what was once a fairly ordinary state university. He really transformed Penn State. He was a brilliant leader. And he was a brilliant leader precisely because he believed in people and he trusted them and he encouraged them and he nurtured them. And people loved Graham Spanier, but people could not accept the fact that the very thing that made him really, really good at his job made him susceptible to a sociopath, right? And you can't have it both ways. You could have a super wary, defensive, paranoid president, if you want, who would have spotted Sandusky a mile away, but he would have been the worst president you'd ever had, right? And people want to have, the argument against Spanier is essentially at the end, an argument that says, why couldn't he have been a perfect human being who is capable of doing these two things simultaneously? And I'm sorry, that person doesn't exist, right? At a certain point, you have to own up to the fact that human beings are imperfect, and sometimes the very thing that makes us bad at detecting deception is the thing that makes us good at everything else. And if you want the good, you got to, you know, Madoff is the price that you pay for having a highly functional financial system. That's a paradox people can't accept, but it's the truth.
Wait, unpack that for a minute.
So what is it that makes the American financial system work in a way that other financial systems do not work? That is because it is a system that rides on trust. We have a number of institutions which people explicitly believe in. We quite happily wire money to, we wire, you know, our life savings to off into the ether under the full expectation they're going to go where we want them to go and be invested the way we want them to be invested. The whole thing is this miracle, really. It's a miracle based on the overwhelming belief that our institutions work the way they are and the majority of people involved in the system are honest. And by the way, they are, majority of them are honest. It so happens that there was one guy in the last generation who persistently and egregiously violated that norm. His name is Bernie Madoff. Now, the worst outcome of the Bernie Madoff scandal would be to put in place a whole series of oversight methods and regulations that undermined the essential trusting nature of the institution, in the hopes that you can prevent another one. Because you don't just like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Like, just accept the fact that the price of a highly functional financial system is an occasional Madoff and move on. Madoff did not bring down the system. We all survived. Many of the people who invested with him got their money back. And also, really, really simple common sense things could have prevented. Like, don't give all your money to one person. Seems like a good principle. Just remember that from now on. Don't give your money to someone who can't describe what they're doing. Good principle. That doesn't require me to be paranoid. And it's just good principle. Like, if someone is doing something and they can't explain what they're doing, don't give them your money. That's just a bedrock kind of. So there's the tendency to overreact. Very often the best response to any kind of crisis is nothing. So, you know, I did this once at the New Yorker Festival. I did a talk on this kind of general theme, at the end of which I asked the audience to say, do you think that if after 9/11 we had done nothing, we had simply got up the next day and said, that was a very sad and tragic event, we're just going to go on with our lives, we would be better off. Every hand in the audience went up. In retrospect, we all realized that virtually everything we did in response to 9/11 was a stupid overreaction, right? Difficult cases make bad law. Like, whatever, it happened. So in response to that, we went and waged an extraordinarily expensive and incredibly stupid war in Iraq, which cost tens of thousands of innocent lives.
More.
Why? And we spent trillions of dollars on correcting this massive bureaucracy, which I continue to see no evidence that it's made us safer. Why? Like, why not just take $2 trillion and, like, help poor people in America? Like, I mean, it's just like the whole thing is just utter madness. And it's just because it is impossible for a politician to stand up and say, to shrug and say.
So I want to go to the financial example for a minute, because I'm trying to think about this as you were saying it. We have a very high trust system. And I think that for people who aren't familiar with this argument, you have a lot of systems where, because you can't trust people you don't know, financial systems, credit systems, business deals, they run on kin, mm-hmm. right? You're trusting within networks that you can have some accountability over. And that mm-hmm. often doesn't work, but at least it's a little closer and you can figure out how to do it. And on the other hand, just while you were talking, I think a reasonable read of the financial crisis is that we had too much trust. That, and this maybe goes to some of your mismatch discussion from earlier and the ways in which we're bad at weighting information. But a lot of people who had the social signifiers of people you should trust, their suits were very expensive and their hair was very gray, were running around saying things were safe and there were AAA ratings on everything. And it all like went to hell. And part of the problem was that at every level, people were trusting things they didn't understand. And so there's a funny way in which systems based on trust are much more efficient. And also at a certain point, if it goes wrong, it can really all go wrong, right? Mm-hmm. Systems that don't have much trust remain smaller. They remain localized. To your point about biographies, you do a smaller biography, right? Mm-hmm. You don't say too much. Mm-hmm. And a danger of systems where you're really trying to optimize for trust and telling people to trust is that Bernie Madoff, I agree, right? Like, it is bad, but, you know, world goes on. But it doesn't seem to me that we have a system we can trust, but we at the same time don't have a good alternative. Like at some point at that level, it's all trust. And I think this is coming in a bunch of other places. I mean, AI and algorithms, we don't know how they work. Mm-hmm. Like we don't know why they make the decisions they do. At some point, we're just trusting computer scientists who made some good calls here.
Yeah.
And the amount of trust you need to operate.
Machine learning, you literally have no idea.
And so on the one hand, you have this great line, and it's something I've been thinking about since I read it, that almost everything that is good in our society comes from our ability to trust, to default to trust. And on the other hand, a ton of what ends up making society fragile is that we have to trust in so many things that we can't ourselves verify, that we're just assuming somebody somewhere is verifying it. But that creates at the center of it like a hollowness, that if it comes down, it comes down for everybody all at once. Unlike if you're trusting your cousin, that only goes as far as people who are that guy's cousin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think what this does is it clarifies what the role of regulators ought to be, that maybe what they should be doing as opposed to hunting for miscreants is simply creating transparency and systems that can boost the resiliency of something like a financial marketplace. So if you think about in case of Madoff, what you had was a broken reputational system. Many, many people on Wall Street did not believe in Madoff. They had all kinds of doubts about him. They were, you know, Goldman forbade its investment managers from investing clients' money with Madoff. But there was no way for that information to be aggregated and made public. And in you could imagine a regulatory system which would have said, we're not actually going to do, you know, stringent individual audits of everyone on Wall Street. What we are going to do is create a mechanism in which that kind of rich local knowledge can be shared. And so we create a kind of feedback loop where those who have good reputations can enhance them in an equitable way. Now, I may have described a kind of fantasy that's impossible to enact, but I think there are ways to kind of manage what you're describing, this fragility of a trust-based system.
So I think trust is actually a good bridge to the other Talking to Strangers I want to chat about with you. So do you know Danielle Allen, the philosopher at Harvard, has a book called Talking to Strangers?
Oh, I long after we were locked in, I learned
this. Yeah, and I don't mean that as like, how dare you use that common title. But I happened to read it shortly before I read your book, because I had her on the podcast for a kind of project I'm doing on democracy. And her book is I had this like fantasy of having both of you do the podcast at the same time. And so you're both just going to come out in the same week, because her book is a very interesting kind of companion in this way that one of the things she's saying is that it is a distinct commentary on America's practices of interpersonal contact and small d democracy, that the word that follows like talking to strangers in our national imagination is don't. That we tell children from the time they're very little that you don't talk to strangers. Strangers are people you should fear. Mm-hmm. That strangers are not a friend you haven't yet met. That strangers are not your countrymen. That strangers are people who are going to take you in a car and off you go. And that there's something very profound and very awry in a country that fears strangers as much as we do. And I'm curious, just having given how much thought you've now given to our relationship with strangers, if that resonates for you.
That is interesting. You know, so when you put that in contemporary context, I'm Canadian and Canada has taken a lot of refugees in the last couple of years. And this country proportionally is doing the opposite. And a really good question to answer is why are Canadians so much more open to the stranger than the United States? Refugees will be the extreme version of what she's talking about, right? Don't admit the stranger. And I wonder about that. What is it about? Is it the feeling that Canada is an ongoing project? Is it the weird structure of Canada that it's basically, you know, five very big cities that are absorbing 98% of these refugees? And so, like, my brother, who's an elementary school principal, he's got like 30 Syrian refugees in his school, right? I mean, it's crazy to think about that. Like, when he thinks about what his job is, it's really interesting to talk to him. It never for a moment occurs to him that there's something weird about the fact that as a elementary school principal in a public school, some huge percentage of his time and attention is taken with the integration of two dozen or more Syrian refugees. That's what he spends his time doing, right? It's his job, essentially. He talks about these kids who come in, they have like PTSD. He had a girl who was acting out in class and she sat, basically he brought her into his office and she sat in, he said, you're going to sit here until you learn that everything is fine and you learn how to behave appropriately. And she sat in his office for like, I forgot, like weeks or something. That's his job, right? It never occurred to him to think that this was somehow an outrage, an imposition. It's just like, it isn't even, when he talks about it, he's not even talking about it like it's this extraordinary event. It's like, that's what I do, right? That's, in fact, he was in a rural school, which was entirely homogeneous. He transferred into the school, an urban school that had a lot of these, because he just thought it would be more interesting. And I said, is that unusual? He's like, no. Lots of teachers, we all prefer to work in interesting schools. Why would you want to teach in a boring school? Like, it was like an incredibly, it was like, it's so different from the narrative that you hear in this country. I'm not making him out to be a saint. He's not a saint. He's just like, he just thinks that's what his job is, right? So there's something about that we're not talking about human fundamentals here. There's something very powerful that's cultural, but it's more than cultural, because cultural suggests something with deep roots. It's about Canada in 2019 is different than America in 2019. And I don't know, I don't know what it is, but it's like not, do you know what I mean? Because you can find a point in American history where the exact same attitudes were held by American primary school principals, right? In New York City in the 1920s, that's what they
and
were.
And the truth is, if you look at our big cities, right, it looks a little bit more like how your brother thinks and how Canada thinks. And America has a different political geography for a bunch of reasons, but although not 100% different, there's plenty of rural Canada too. But I always think it's important to note how much the variation is and how people look at this. The other thing that I was thinking reading the two books in close proximity is that your book fundamentally, I think, forces readers to confront this question of orientation, right? Do we want to orient towards trust, knowing that the cost is going to be getting lied to? Mm-hmm. Or do we want to orient towards suspicion, knowing that the cost will be that we can't build the
effective
communities and institutions that rely on trust? And her book, which is about democracy, is about this question sort of similarly. Democracy requires us to sacrifice things for each other. And basically, actually a little bit to our discussion of generous orthodoxy, that's sort of a place where we have it, that decisions come down and we kind of live with them, you know, and we just hope it turns out better the next time for us. And her argument here is that there is either a way of living within that in a space of suspicion and anger, which ultimately is going to become unstable, or you have to cultivate a very different version of political friendship, recognizing that you're going to often feel betrayed. And in both cases, it seems to me that there's like a fundamentally optimistic story being told here, but one that is very difficult to square with the weight that we in the media and we in the political system and we sort of in the stories we tell want to put on negative experience. Mm-hmm. That we are heavily oriented towards telling ourselves and each other the stories of when it doesn't work as opposed to the stories of when it does. Mm-hmm. And so both in the stories that you were talking about and in the kind of broader political structure that she's talking about, it seems to me that the media actually has a role here about what kinds of stories do we orient towards telling, because that's going to help decide what kinds of stories people tell to each other. Mm. This is a place where I've often found you to be a bit critical of the media. We've talked about it before in certain places. I wanted to hear you reflect on this a bit and like what an alternative model of trying to orient towards trust and orient towards recognizing the upside of the trade-offs might look like.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I have a good answer to that, because you could even argue that I am a prey to a little bit of that in this book.
Your stories are about times when it went bad.
Yeah, I tell a lot of stories about times going bad in order to make the point that we shouldn't spend too much time talking about things that go bad.
So yes.
I am to blame in a certain way. Maybe in my defense and in the media's defense, I would say, do stories about things that go bad help to kind of clarify our understanding of what good looks like? Mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, you can't, if you write a book about how things are going really well, it's not going to be a very interesting book. I mean, part of this is just a problem with stories. That's, you know, where is the drama if it's all
probably about... Tipping Point had a little bit more of that quality. A lot of things went well in Tipping Point,
I suppose. And Outliers was a story about success. I suppose it is kind of, maybe I've gotten kind of gloomy at some point. I don't know. What's that?
It's a gloomy time.
I don't have a kind of good, I don't have a good answer to that. I'm always struck, the only thing I will say is that I'm always struck by the book I'm obsessed with. I'm meaning to read it, but I've been reading about it endlessly, is, you know, this Washington Post reporter, Chris Ingraham, who moves to northwestern Minnesota from
He's written a book on it now?
Yeah, he's written a book on it, yeah. And it's all this kind of argument for the virtues of small town life, which resonates with me because that's where I grew up. I grew up in essentially the Canadian
equivalent. Real quick, for people who don't know this story, Chris Ingraham, who's at the Post, is at Wonk Blog, which was my vertical there. He wrote a story, as I remember this, about how like this one town is like the worst town in America for some reason or another, like on some
weather,
set of metrics.
Weather, amenities, you know, it's all flat, there's no hills, all kinds of reasons.
And then somehow out of that, people in the town convinced him to visit.
Yeah.
And then the visits convinced him to move there. So he moved to the town that he had named in a national publication the worst town in America.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I've read him write about this. I didn't know that the book had come out.
And he has a hilarious Twitter. I don't know if you follow his Twitter.
Yes.
It's the best Twitter.
Well, I follow it to the extent that I follow people on Twitter and try not to read them.
Yeah. You know, your Twitter strategy sounds like it's wrong. My Twitter strategy is I only follow like 35 people. So I read all. So I read 100% of Chris Ingraham's Twitter and 100% of Matt Iglesias' Twitter.
I try not to read Twitter.
Oh,
I follow everybody and try not to read the platform.
Oh, I see. But anyway, he's very funny, and I just love. There was something, and I just one of the things that's almost it's a cliche, but it's worth underscoring, is the gap between the kind of experience that he's describing in this town and the way that living in America is represented. And I read an interview with him yesterday, over his book. And the interview brings up the question of race, which is a legitimate question. There are no black people in the little town where he lives. But at the same time, I thought, you know, there are lots and lots and lots of Americans for whom that's not part of their lived experience. You know, it's like, it doesn't, you know, that's something we not everyone in America wrestles with the issue of race on an ongoing basis. And so it's like sometimes when we talk about this issue, we're assuming that it's in the lives of everyone, and it's not actually. There are huge swaths of the country that are struggling with other issues, but not necessarily that one. And that kind of the notion of I think we undersell the diversity of experience in America, that you can go to a place like Northwestern Minnesota, and the roster of things that are on people's concern list is just totally different, right? And when I was growing up, no one ever said a single word about the quality of the schools. Never. I mean, one was that everyone went to the public school. We all knew the teachers they all lived in. The notion that you would criticize the school was like, when we had things we cared about, that was just not it. Like, but that same thing in, you know, Brooklyn, totally different. It's number one, probably, right, on the list of things people talk and care about. It's just like that representing the, maybe if we did a better job, I think, as journalists, at representing that kind of diversity of experiencing concerns, maybe that would help matters a little bit.
Well, that's to demystify more of my mysterious book. One of the things I write about in the book and track is the nationalization of political concern. So we've had this collapse of state and local media. But not just a collapse in state and local media. We've also just had a shift over towards just various forms of nationalized media. So when I grew up in Irvine, California, we got the LA Times. I listened to KCRW, LA public radio, which is great music. And I was interested in national politics. But because I happened to consume so many more state-oriented news sources, I had an extremely strong California political identity. I was very concerned with things happening in LA.
Yeah.
And if I were there now, right? If I were growing up now, I'm sure that I don't know if my family subscribes to the LA Times still, but I think we probably wouldn't. Even though now it's going through revitalization, it had some very, very bad years. And I'd probably have an online subscription to the New York Times, and I would listen to national podcasts, and yeah. I would have access to all this national news. And so to your point about there are a lot of swaths of the country that don't deal with this or that issue, one of the interesting things is that increasingly, like people feel like they are dealing with the same issues, even if they're not literally dealing with them. Like, this is not a thing the media has done in the sense of we have changed what we cover, but it is a thing the media industry has done in changing its internal composition and tilting much more towards high scale, supranational news sources. It's a great book by, I want to say Daniel Hopkins, but it may be David. There's like 18 political scientists named Daniel David Hopkins called The Increasingly United States. And he shows in all these different ways that the ways our state and national identities have switched places. But the one I really love is that for most of, if you look at the sort of, if you look at the book text analyses, for most of American history, either the phrase, I am Californian, Virginian, Pennsylvanian, whatever, was either outpacing or about tied with I'm American. And just since World War II, like I'm American races off and then never looks back. And so for so long, we had these state identities that, and he shows us in a bunch of other ways too, were pretty fundamental to us. And the concerns of the individual state, like state platforms, had local issues in them, mm-hmm. not national issues. But now state Democratic and Republican platforms are basically just a national platform. Mm-hmm. And like that's, I think, a pretty under-noticed contributor that's to really mega polarization.
Do you ever read the Peter Taylor short story about, I think it's called A Summons? Oh, it's in the book, A Summons from Memphis.
No.
I think it is the title short story. I may be getting this wrong. But it's all about, for someone living in Tennessee, the enormous difference between being from Memphis and being from Nashville. It's kind of great. It's well, exactly what you're talking about, that in that era, he's writing in about the 30s, mm-hmm. I think. In that era, that was the thing. Your mindset was so local that like the thing it impressed upon you was, oh my God, if you're in Memphis, Nashville is like, you know, beyond the pale and vice versa. And now to your point, now next up was I am a summons from Tennessee, and now it would be a summons from Washington, D.C.
So I think that's a good place to come to a close. So let me ask you our normal ending question is, what are three books you'd recommend to the audience?
Well, we mentioned one.
Exit Voice and Loyalty.
Exit Voice and Loyalty by Alfred O. Hirschman. We talked about Janet Malcolm. So maybe I should recommend a Janet Malcolm book. Basically, any Janet Malcolm book. They are all uniformly brilliant. I sometimes think that Journalist and the Murderer is the best, but I think any of them in the Freud archives is incredible. And then a third book. Well, this is just one I read recently that I really, really loved. I read a book. I've forgotten the name of the author. It's called, it's about the last days of the Shah of Iran. It's so interesting. God, I'm embarrassed. I can't remember.
We will find the author and put it in show notes.
Okay, good. Yes. But those would be my three.
Malcolm Gladwell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you to Malcolm Gladwell for being here. If you enjoyed this show or enjoy any of the others, please rate us on Apple Podcasts or just text the show to your friend. That is how we grow, and I'm always grateful if you take a moment and do it. Thank you to Jeremy Dalmas for engineering, to Roger Karma for researching, to Jeffrey Geld for producing. My email, as always, EzraKleinShow@Vox.com, and The Ezra Klein Show is a Vox Media podcast production.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.